The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
David Mitchell is hands down my favorite author. And now I understand there's a name for me, and I guess for us. We're called Mitchell Geeks. Every book is surprising and delicious. It is different than his others and different than anything else you are reading at the time. It just makes my heart happy to see him get the recognition that he deserves. And he definitely got recognized with the story of Jacob de Zoet. We Mitchell Geeks are in good company. NPR's Maureen Corrigan calls him the postmodern wunderkind. Dave Edgars in the New York Times calls him the real deal, the one of the more fascinating and fearless writers alive. James Wood in the New Yorker calls him an artist of surplus. He seems to have more stories than he quite knows what to do with, and he ranges across a remarkable variety of genres, conventional historical fiction, dystopian sci-fi, and literary farce. Kazuo Ishiguro says, "I was exhilarated, the exhilaration of being swept along into another different world. It's sheer joy." And the kudos go on and on. Would you please join me in welcoming David Mitchell?
I came here dressed for an Irish kind of June, July, with kind of thick coats and waterproofs and everything, and I've been melting ever since I arrived the day before yesterday. Oh, thank you very much for being here. You caught me by surprise. The last time I was here, I was up in a fairly small place up on the third floor, and whoa, where's the back? But it's great to be here, and thank you for coming out on a... steamy, is it Wednesday today?
Tuesday.
It started. It's Tuesday. It must be Philadelphia. But no, you catch me at the beginning of a book tour when America's still really exotic. I was just looking out of my hotel room earlier, and I'm up on the 30th floor, and it's like Google Earth, and it's just looking down. It's, wow, this is America. This is amazing. In about a week. Anyway, I thought I'd just start with a shortish reading, and then I'm really happy to do some questions with you. This is just to sort of get me into event mode, really. I think I'll just jump straight in and interrupt myself when I feel it's necessary. Picking slugs from the cabbages with a pair of chopsticks, Jacob notices a ladybird on his right hand. He makes a bridge for it with his left, which the insect obligingly crosses. Jacob repeats the exercise several times. The ladybird believes, he thinks, she is on a momentous journey, but she is going nowhere. He pictures an endless sequence of bridges between skin-covered islands over voids and wonders if an unseen force is playing the same trick on him. Until a woman's voice dispels his reverie. Mr. Dazuto? Jacob removes his bamboo hat and stands up. Miss Ibagawa's face eclipses the sun. I beg pardon to disturb. Surprise, guilt, nervousness, Jacob feels many things. She notices the ladybird on his thumb. Tentor mushy. In his eagerness to comprehend, he mishears. Or bentor mushy? Or bentor mushy? The people who laugh at that have some knowledge of Japanese, so you just gave yourself away. Or bentor mushy is luncheon box bug, she smiles. This, she indicates the ladybird, is or tentor mushy. Tentor mushy, he says, and she nods like a pleased teacher. Her deep blue summer kimono and white headscarf lend her a nun's air. They're not alone. The inevitable guard stands by the garden gate. Guard, garden. Ah, they clash, don't they? Guard, garden. Inevitable guard, the inevitable mind. No. It's too late to do a product recall now. Happens, though, sort of when I was checking and polishing the manuscript by eye, there's no problem. But only when you read it, garden, garden. Jacob tries to ignore him. Ladybird, in Dutch, a gardener's friend. Anna would like you, he thinks, looking into her face. Anna would like you. I've got to explain that. Anna's his fiancée back in Zeeland, in the Netherlands, for whom he's really taken this malaria lottery to come out east to make his fortune, because he's from a rather lower social circle to her. And his prospective father-in-law says, first you make your money. Some things never change. And although he sort of betrothed his future to her, it's a long, long way away, 5 years away, and men are men. But don't hold it against him too much. He's a nice guy, really. A gardener's friend, because ladybirds eat greenfly. Jacob raises his thumb to his lips and blows. The ladybird flies all of 3 feet to the scarecrow's face. She adjusts the scarecrow's hat as a wife might. How you call him? Oh, he's a scarecrow in Dutch, to scare crows away. But this one's name is Robespierre. Warehouse Ake is Warehouse Oak. I should explain. I love this about the Dutch. They name their warehouses the same way the British and the Americans name their ships. That's sort of interesting and kind of worthwhile insight into the Dutch national psyche. A good insight, of course, if there's any Dutch people in the audience, I'd like it. But it's cool. Warehouse Oak. Monkey is William Pitt. Why scarecrow is Robespierre? Because his head falls off when the wind changes. It's kind of a dark joke. Joke is secret language, she frowns, inside words. Jacob decides against referring to the fan until she does. It would appear, at least, that she's not offended or angered. I will stop interrupting myself in a minute, honestly, but the fan is kind of important. The very first time they met, just two encounters ago, she left a fan, one of these opening, closing Japanese fans, in the warehouse where he was doing some work. And he was struck by her then. He remembered her face and disassembled the fan, drew her face on it and reassembled it and sort of slipped it to her when he thought the guard wasn't looking. So that's what the fan is. And if you want to see the fan, then it's on page 280-something, drawn by my mum, of all people. It's a bit Spinal Tap, isn't it, to kind of get your mum to be a bit Yoko Ono, I'm not sure. But she was an artist in a former life, so she's done a good job. And it didn't cost me a cent either. So, mum, would you mind? What is it this time? May I help you, miss? Yes, Dr. Malinus asks for Laws of Mary. He asks, the better I know Malinus, thinks Jacob, the less I understand him. He asks, bid Domburger give you 6 sprogs of Laws of Mary? Over here, then, in the herb garden. He leads her down the path, unable to think of a single pleasantry that doesn't sound terminally inane. She asks, why Mr. Dazuto worked today as Dejima gardener? Because, the real reason is he lost a gambling debt with a doctor and he has to pay it back by digging horse manure into the garden. But he's not going to tell her that. Because, the pastor's nephew lies through his teeth, I enjoy a garden's company. As a boy, he leavens his lie with some truth, as a boy I worked in a relative's orchard. We cultivated the first plum trees ever to grow in our village. In village of Domburg, she says, in province of Zeeland. You're most kind to remember. Jacob breaks off a half dozen young sprigs. Here you are. And for a priceless coin of time, their hands are linked by a few inches of fragrant herb, witnessed by a dozen blood orange sunflowers. I don't want a purchased courtesan, he thinks. I wish to earn you. Thank you, she smells the herb. Rosemary has meaning. Jacob blesses his foul-breathed martinet of a Latin master back in Middleburg. Its Latin name is Rosmarinus, wherein Los is dew. Dew. Would you know the word dew? She frowns and shakes her head a little, and her parasol spins very slowly. Dew. Dew is water found early in the morning before the sun burns it away. Dew. And the midwife understands. Dew, we say asatsuyu. And Jacob knows he shall never forget the word asatsuyu so long as he lives. Well, Ros being dew and Marinus meaning ocean, Ros Marinus, rosemary, is dew of the ocean. Old people say that rosemary thrives, grows well, only when it can hear the ocean. And the story pleases her. Is it true tale? It may be... Let time stop, Jacob wishes. Let time stop. It may be prettier than it is true. Meaning of Marinus is sea. So Dr. Marinus is Dr. Ocean. You could say so, yes. Does Iba Gawa have a meaning? Iba is indigo. Her pride in her name is plain. And Gawa is river. So you are an indigo river. You sound like a poem. And you, Jacob tells himself, sound like a flirty lecturer. Rosemary is also a woman's Christian name. I mean, a given name. My own given name is... He strains to sound casual. Jacob. She swivels her head to show puzzlement. What is Jacob? It's the name my parents gave me. Jacob. So my full name is Jacob de Zoet. She gives a cautious nod. Jacobu Dazuto. I wish, he thinks, spoken words could be captured and kept in a locket. Miss Ibergout asks, my pronounce is not very good. No, you're perfect. Your pronounce is perfect. Crickets skitter and clerk in the garden's low walls of sounds. I invent these onomatopoeic verbs sometimes just to irritate my translators because they spend days looking through and typing them in. And then the email comes, I can't find this word. And Miss Ibergawa, Jacob swallows, what is your given name? She makes him wait. My name from mother and father is Olito. The breeze twists a coil of her hair around its finger. She looks down. Doctor is waiting. Thank you for rosemary. Jacob says, you're most welcome. And doesn't dare say more. She takes three or four paces and turns back. I forget a thing. She reaches into her sleeve and produces a fruit, the size and hue of an orange, but smooth as hairless skin from my garden. I bring many to Dr. Malinus, so he asks I take one to Mr. Dazuto. It is kaki. Then in Japanese, persimmon is a kaki. Kaki. She rests it on the crook of the scarecrow's shoulder. Kaki. Robespierre and I shall share it later, thank you. Her wooden slippers crunch the friable earth as she walks along the path. Act, implores the ghost of future regret. I shan't give you another chance. Jacob hurries past the tomatoes and catches her up near the gate. Miss Ibergawa, I must ask you to forgive me. She has turned and has one hand on the gate. Why forgive? For what I now say. The marigolds are molten. You are beautiful. Her mouth opens and closes. She takes a step back into the wicket gate. It rattles. The guard swings it open. Oh, you damned fool, groans the demon of present regret. What have you done? Crumpling, burning and freezing, Jacob retreats. But the garden has quadrupled in length, and it may take a wandering Jew's eternity before he reaches the cucumbers, where he kneels behind a screen of dock leaves, where the snail on the pail flexes its stumpy horns, where ants carry patches of rhubarb leaf along the shaft of a hoe. And he wishes the earth might spin backwards to the moment when she first appeared, asking for rosemary. And he would do it all again, and he would do it all differently. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. You're very kind.
I've drunk too much water, so how are we doing for time? I am really happy to take any questions that any of you may have. I'll sort of do the moderating myself. I've been told to beg you please to wait until the microphone arrives where you are. Of course, this will completely backfire if nobody has any questions, so save my face for me. And if you're sort of half thinking, oh, I might ask him, might not, please do it, otherwise look really... There's a gentleman here. Thank you very much. A brief round of applause for having the guts for us. First person. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Number one, welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Okay. Just listening to the book, I heard a little bit of it this morning on Radio Times, and now I'm hearing it here. And one of the things that interests me are foreign languages. So I'm noticing, of course, in this case, the conversation is going on in English in which you're writing, with references to Dutch and to Japanese. Mm. Now, you talked briefly about driving the translators crazy. Do you speak the languages yourself, these different languages yourself, or do you just make them do it?
I suspect I speak fewer languages than you. My Japanese is okay. My wife happens to be from Japan, so that's always a prime motivator, especially when you're younger. And I lived for about half a year in Holland, so I know more about Dutch than I actually know Dutch. And they're such good linguists there. You sort of crank out this awful mangle joke of a Dutch sentence, and they answer back in fluent, beautiful, modulated English, and you feel like a crushed slug. So I didn't get too far in my Dutch studies, I must admit. But I went badly wrong twice with this book. It took 4 years, and really the first 2 years wasn't completely wasted, but the architecture of the book was very different. And one of the reasons I went wrong was that I was trying, or I saw that this linguistic incomprehension, which would have been the case in reality, a handful of Dutch translators existed in Japan. It was a father to son business that was passed down. Historical records show they weren't that good, and the Dutch always complaining about being unable to speak. They officially were forbidden to learn Japanese, and of course we're in an age where Japan was locked off from the outside world, had been for 150 years, no dictionaries, no nice internet websites to help you, nothing. Really working in the dark, or just working with whatever God-given software faculty for language they happen to have. And I was thinking, I wanted this big book, and there's Dutch and Japanese, and I can't have them sort of forever not understanding each other. So I devised all sorts of weird subplots that where some of the translators smuggled themselves down to Batavia. It was horrible. And he's like, I remember from high school science, there's the idea of the point of elasticity, where you can stretch a piece of elastic, and up to the point of elasticity, when you let go, it goes back, but past the point of elasticity, you're left with a piece of broken elastic. And in my first manuscript, I had lots of pieces of broken elastic littering the place, because I've gone past the point of plausibility. So what did I do? I'd spent the advance, so I was in trouble. Had to get this book in. But I'd forgotten again that restrictions can be your friends, that your problems, if only you can sort of get inside them and turn them inside out, then strange, new, original things can happen. And then I realised it wasn't an enemy of the book at all. It was a great ally. It's an asset. Non-communication sort of is one of these sort of recurring whack-a-mole themes that kind of keep appearing in my books, if I want them there or not. My last thing was about a kid with a speech disfluency, and it appears in other books as well a bit. And I thought, this is great, I should bring this on stage. No, they can't understand each other very well. They're forever having to sort of say, are you understanding me? And there's a section where one of the translators, kind of the narrative, the camera is mounted on his head, and he's having to translate quite high level Dutch lecture into Japanese, and we actually see what his mind's doing as he's thinking about it, and so he's speaking, and I don't know that word, and he's having to guess, but he, kind of his audience is looking at him doing this, and that's exactly the kind of scene I was afraid of and wanted to avoid, but actually it's one of the scenes that I'm most proud of in the finished book. So note to self, your enemies are your friends. That was a big rambling answer. Have I done justice to your question? If you just give the gentleman the microphone back once more.
I must admit, it seemed like a lot of fun going in, and going back to that theme where you were talking about the ladybird beetle going from hand to hand, basically the language is sort of standing in for another type of bridge for the communication between people of different cultures. By the way, ohayo gozaimasu.
Domo, domo. That's a beautiful metaphor. Thank you. Your metaphor saying that the language is also a bridge, that's a beautiful metaphor, and you wrote that. Anyway, there's a gentleman. Oh, there's two questions over there. I will go boing, 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 boing. Okay, and great.
I'm Jan Doof. I don't know whether the name rings a bell to you. I'm
Doof,
great,
most
great
certainly.
Grandson of Henrik Doof.
You are the great grandson of Henrik Doof.
My wife, Anik, is translated his recollections.
Wow, I mentioned you in my acknowledgements.
It's been an inspiration for the
oh, you magazine. Bet, just a bit. Oh, I saw him coming down. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, I have to explain what that's about.
Make a statement, but I was just wondering what turned you on about Henrik that made you write the book that you wrote. It's a wonderful story. And
well, it's his story. Yes, indeed. I must explain. I was doing a reading in Rotterdam in about 2002. This is the Cloud Atlas one, I think. And I mentioned I had an interest in Dejima, and a gentleman who must be one of your relatives, he approached me afterwards and said, my sister-in-law? George, yes. Yes. He's a relative of yours.
Yes.
Yes. Your brother-in-law. Okay, that works. My sister-in-law in North America recently translated this book, and it is the memoirs of a man called Henrik Doof, who was the chief resident of Dejima in Nagasaki. He was there, I think, between about 1800 and 1817. Okay. Probably one person in the world could have accurately corrected me there. And he happens to be here. Dejima existed for about 240 years. Gosh, they're kind of... 200... My specifics will get a lot more general this evening than they have ever been. There were many Dejimas. It looks different at different times. The shape was always the same, but a place like that evolves. And the configuration of the buildings were different at different times. And it was a long time. And Without Her did a huge, great, epic, sort of a book, which I didn't really want to. I had to choose my window of time in which to set the book, and I chose the Napoleonic era chiefly because of this book by Hendrik Doof. What turned me on about him? He's a fascinating figure. The rules were you were allowed to stay there for 5 years. The Japanese didn't want officials making a network of their own because they could then they would then be less dependent on the bureaucracy. However, due to the British, who found themselves on the other, well, conveniently found themselves on opposing sides from the Dutch during the Napoleonic Wars, the British used the opportunity to seize Dutch ships and to cherry-pick Dutch possessions overseas. And Doof was marooned there. He couldn't get back to Java, and the ships stopped coming year after year after year. And it would be a little bit like being on a manned space station orbiting Mars, and suddenly the transmissions from Earth stop, and you have no idea why. You've got nothing. You don't know if you'd ever get back. He wrote about that. He was also the chief resident in Dejima when the HMS Phaeton arrived in 1808. this is where the British sail into Nagasaki Harbour. They want to break open the Japanese market. They want what they think is a Dutch possession that they've heard about. And they say, right, Mr. Doof, your country no longer exists, which in fact was the case. The Netherlands was turned into just a department of France in 1806. And hand over the keys. And he refused. He was given this lousy hand of cards to play in this very dangerous poker game of diplomacy and force. Had nothing to play with, but nonetheless he refused to fold, and he had one great card, which was Dutch guile, and he bluffed the British, and he ended up using the British as a transit service. It's stunning what he did. And it was such a good story that actually another reason I went wrong in an early manuscript, the historical novel, I erred too much on the side of history, and I started to write something that was looking very much like his biography, but rather embellished by myself, that's another reason why it didn't quite work. Fiction has its own demands that you can't ignore either. It's a fine line. There's a lot of his genetic code in Jacob de Zoet, most certainly. The names are almost the same, Doof and Zoet. And you know, when you're working, these happy accidents, just a book falls into your lap like that, it can be more useful than things you go in search of. So thank your ancestor from me when you meet him. Many years from now, I hope. Thank you very much for your question. That was great. Thank you very much. Only at the Free Library in Philadelphia will that kind of thing happen, I think. I should move on to a gentleman. There's one here. There's two gentlemen sitting next to each other there. Then I'll come back to a gentleman in the front row. And then I'll go to the left side of the house. Evening, sir.
Good evening to you. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
In the Paris Review Writers at Work series, which I know you have not, I believe, participated in yet, but one of the things they ask each of the writers is about their habits of composition, how they actually put the words out into the world and the time they spend during the day and that kind of thing. Could you speak briefly about how you compose?
How I compose, what a lovely verb, the grubby little hut with mess and paper. Thank you. I've got two, I've got an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old, and anyone who also has an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old knows that you do it when you can, when the kids allow me, really. When I'm getting close to a deadline, then Dad is in the hut and he mustn't be disturbed, and my long-suffering wife brings me food out on a meal, food out on a tray, and I work hard and long and in a concentrated way, and I have to make it up for them big time afterwards. An ideal day is I do the school run. We live about 3 miles out of our small little local Irish town where my daughter goes to school. I drop her off. We've got a small little house there as well, so I work there while she's at school and have a break for lunch, pick her up at 2:40. Hopefully I do, otherwise I'm really deep into the work and I think, no, it's 3 o'clock and I have to go back and my daughter's the last one left and the teacher happened to go, I know, happened a couple of times and the regret. A splinter of ice, of plutonium in my heart. Then I take her back and mess around with the kids for a bit and maybe get an hour in before we eat. If it's my turn to cook, then not. Maybe an hour afterwards, then get the kids off to bed. And then again, it's quite good to work at night. So, I start off in my notebook, and then when I get itchy to see what it looks like on not the big screen, but on the small screen in a nice font, then yeah, after half an hour or so, I sort of get impatient. And I can't start off with a blank screen. I can start off with a blank page. A blank screen is no good, but a blank page, it's got ways in that a screen hasn't got. I like tea. Tea's my friend, my ally, and my love, and I've got a big, I've got 30, 40 teas on the go at any one time, and it's a Darjeeling sort of an afternoon, or it's a rough night last night, it's got to be Assam in the morning, or I've got a few rare Chinese ones that I get from an importer, and that's, I'm a happy man. Thank you very much. There's a gentleman next to you, since the microphone is in that neck of the woods. Oh, it's not, but then front row, then over to you. So you will be about 4 from now, time allowing.
I'd like to welcome you to Philadelphia. And
thank you
I'd
very
like
much.
To ask you a question about Sanmi from Cloud Atlas.
By all means.
Wonderful character. And
thank you
for creating her.
Oh, my pleasure.
And without spoiling it for our colleagues here who may not have experienced it, I'll just say that Sanmi is a fabricated human being, and she has many adventures because she ascends to humanity. And it's described in tremendous detail. Sanmi goes to college. Sanmi gets shot at. Sanmi has all sorts of experiences. But the one experience that she has that in she has sex, but it's mentioned in passing. There is no development of that particular major event in Sanmi's life. And I'm just curious because there's obviously nothing here that you haven't thought about. Would you care to comment on
on my fabricant's sex life? Yeah, sure. This is why I like this. This is why I do a short reading. And no journalist ever has asked me a question remotely like it. It's such a relief. I don't have to kind of go onto autopilot and pretend I'm not. This is so. Thank you. However, as you were speaking, I was thinking, she has sex, does she? Really? Who's that? I wrote it about 8-9 years ago. God, man, time flies. That's after she's escaped and she's in that rather grungy place. Yeah. And they have sex, do they? Wow. I honestly forgot. No, really? Wow. She's probably one of the hardest persons, one of the hardest to realize characters I've ever written. I could never work out how she would speak, really. She would sort of be downloaded with the vocabulary of 400 or 500, and had real problems when I was writing that, thinking, okay, she's got this vocabulary now, and she's looking back and to a time when she couldn't speak, and how would they speak? How could that? Blah, 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 blah. Should it be a Flowers for Algernon kind of thing? And indeed, when I tried to read from that section, when I was sort of on book tour, I soon stopped trying to read from that. It works on the page, but if I ever tried to read her voice, I couldn't inflect it. I didn't know how to. It ended up sounding like the computer on the USS Enterprise. So I've got a strange relationship with her. I don't quite know how she works, which makes it sound quite mystical and sort of, gosh, yes, the people I write, they come alive and tell me what they want to do. And when authors do that, I think, oh, you're just, no, you're just a grubby little sentence writer. Stop it now. But it's sort of as if they come alive and they tell me what they want to do. She wouldn't be sort of genetic. I mean, there's no genetic reason for her to gain pleasure from sex, of course. So I imagine the engineers, the genomicists, who devise that model of server, at best would have ignored that aspect of her anatomy, and at worst would have sort of actively conspired to neutralize it completely. Presumably she doesn't menstruate, she won't be reproducing, she's just sort of discarded after her active life. So this is quite curious. I'm sort of putting myself into other people's minds, even though she sort of originated in mine. I'm guessing that she does that because she has noticed how fundamental an experience it is to real, ascended, pure-blood human beings. And she does possess intellectual curiosity. Of all things, I'm reminded of George Eliot, who, of course, the Victorian female writer, who, by contemporary accounts, was not exactly a pin-up girl. And she approached a friend, an older man. She had never had sex, but she rather like, sort of, I'm imagining Somni would, wanted to do it to understand it and to kind of see what all the fuss was about, as it were. And so she proposed to this friend and said, you know, sort of, I'm a novelist, there's this key human experience that because of my gender and time and place I live, I haven't experienced. What about it? And the gentleman thought for a while and said, thank you, but no thank you. And there's a strange dignity behind that anecdote. Both sides, I feel, come out of it rather well. This is not what you'd think, but I think they do. And later she then went on and had a relationship with someone she loved and who loved her, and that was much better. Another rambly answer. Intellectual curiosity, I am guessing, would be her main motivator. And thank you for asking me a question I've never heard before. That's just great. And if anyone's sort of thinking, oh, should I ask him that? And please do. The more eccentric, the better. It's great. Right, now who did I promise next? Front row gentleman, then over here somewhere. So
I hope this isn't too much of an eccentric writer's question.
I love them.
Do books like Shogun get in the way? And if so, how does one get around them? Or do they help? What do you do with books like that?
Do books like Shogun get in the way? I saw the miniseries with... Now, I was confused Richard Carpenter with Richard Chamberlain, Carpenter, A Dangerous Mistake. I saw it when I was a kid, and deliberately didn't read the book because I was afraid it might get in the way. That was 120 years or so before my period anyway, way back when Japan was being closed up, based on Will Adams, an Englishman who I think went over with the Dutch. He was there with maybe one of the first Dutch ships. An English merchant, learnt the language. Oh, that's another great thing about Doof. He learnt the language. First European to speak really good Japanese since the days of the Jesuits. Amazing, amazing mind. And he wrote a dictionary as well. And for a long time, the word for dictionary in Japanese was the doof. It's just great. However, Will Adams didn't really get in the way. I was more able to shoplift from his life and feed some of his openness and his intellectual curiosity into Jacob de Zoet than James Clavell's Will Adams got in the way of what I was trying to do. There's another really good book by an American. It's about an inn on the main road. For a while, the Japanese had the best roads in the world during this period. Other aspects of technology fell behind, but they had the best roads in the world, the best paved, the best maintained, the longest, the smoothest, and they kind of invented the idea of everyone driving on the left, or everyone driving on one side, because in Europe at the time, there was no convention that everyone either goes on the left or on the right. It was just bang all the time, and the more important could go through, and the less important were supposed to, oh yes, my lord. The Japanese Inn by Oliver, can anyone help me? You know the book? No, it's the Japanese. Now the connection with Clavell is that he blurbed it, that was really good. It's a great book. It's out of print, I think, but there's hard research where you go through archives and work things out and speak to academics and sort of hard and soft, as in hard technology and soft technology. Then there's soft research where you read books like that. Shogun, if you wish. I had a voice at the back of my head saying people are going to be comparing this with Shogun a lot anyway, just because I'm kind of a gaijin writing about a gaijin in Japan. Probably best to sort of ward off unflattering comparisons at this stage simply by honestly not reading him. So I guess that was how I handled him, by running in the opposite direction. Not a good idea in your love life, but it does work in literature sometimes. Thank you very much for that. Right, gentleman here, then the blue shirt at the back, about halfway up.
Hi.
Hi.
I saw your last reading, and I'm so happy for you that you graduated to the auditorium.
thank you.
That wasn't my question. Japan, Korea, Hawaii, New Zealand. I was just wondering if you could talk about what is it about, pardon the loose terminology, the Pacific Rim, the cultures, the histories, the geographies that kind of draws you there as an author, both creatively and physically, since you've spent so much time in Japan.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's a non-journalist question. That's a real non-journalist question. It's a big rambly one, so I'll do a big rambly.
If that one didn't work, I was going to ask you, you could certainly talk about other characters and what they're thinking when they're having sex, but, the Pacific Rim one is good, too.
Quite enough of that sort of thing for one evening. Thank you very much, young man. A lot of my books do have a Pacific Rim influence. It's true. wherever you are in your 20s, that is where you gather a lot of your raw material for the books, if you happen to go on and become a writer in your 30s or your 40s. I'm a lot less mobile now. So if I want to set things away from home, I have to sort of just refer to my memories. It's not America. And you produce so much here, and so much of the world is looking at America, that there is more unexplored areas in the world's opposites of America. And one of the world's opposites of America is that sort of big ocean that's so wide it isn't really an ocean, the Pacific. It's big. Oh, this is pure gold, isn't it? Yes. I went to see David Mitchell. He told me how big the Pacific was. It made sense in Cloud Atlas to sort of set one of these last little strongholds of survivors of civilization there, just because of the vastness of the Pacific would insulate it from whatever else had happened, whatever had happened in the rest of the world to bring down all of this. The Chatham Islands, they really captured my imagination. A small group of islands several hundred miles east of New Zealand, somewhere around the international dateline. First inhabited by a group of Maori who presumably were blown off course, then lost the art of shipbuilding, and after a few generations came to believe that they were it. They were the only land on Earth, and they were the only people on Earth. Beautiful, fascinating and strange, and it's the sort of thing that makes my little onboard novelist's Geiger counter go the Korean section in Cloud Atlas is Korean because I was going to do a completely different story about a Korean rap star based loosely on a real-life figure from a short-lived rap duo called Drunken Tiger. And I'd gone to Seoul and done research and went around and then realised this book was getting too long. And I was writing another thing about a gifted young musician again. Same book, too many. So instead of 3-3-3, three in the past, three in the present, three in the future, I scaled it down to 2-2-2. But I'd be damned if I was going to let all that research go to waste. So that's why that section is set there. And I'm probably the 21st century will be the East Asian century in the same way the 19th was the British and the 20th the American. I don't know, but look at the way the economies are growing, and it's not an implausible guess. Big rambly answer. To know why some places just light you up more than others. I don't know. I'll try and work out a better answer for the next time I come. Ask it, and I'll give you a really impressive boom, boom, sort of. Great. Me too. Thanks very much. Gentleman in the blue shirt's been very patient at the back there.
I was sort of wondering, going from Cloud Atlas to Black Swan Green, it made me think of about 20 years ago in a modern literature class where the professor said that Pynchon wrote The Crying of Lot 49 simply so he'd be taught because his other novels were such difficult reading or so long or so involved that I kind of thought the same thing when I read that. I was like, he went from, wow, this is really complex, to something that was complex but not nearly as, you didn't have to pay quite the attention to what was going on. And
So my question isn't not necessarily why you went from those two, but what would be the inspiration for Cloud Atlas and then the inspiration for Black Swan Green?
Sure. Thank you very much. And you're making a flattering comparison with me and Pynchon there. I would say that I think compared to Gravity's Rainbow, which is sort of like being imprisoned inside a cubist painting in eight dimensions, Cloud Atlas is sort of like Mary and John go to the zoo. Is it really? People find things in it, and I might not necessarily have put them there, but I think there are good reasons to find them, and I do think they're there. And I think a book is a three-stage artifact: the mind of the writer, the thing itself, and the mind of the reader. And things can be in the third stage that are really valid and really there that might not have been that consciously sort of inserted in the first stage. However, inspirations. Somewhat prosaically, Cloud Atlas is sort of first little stem cell was a book by Italo Calvino called If on a Winter's Night a Traveller, which is a sort of sequence of, you get about a four-page narrative in the style of a famous writer. Chekhov, Mishima, etc. It's sometimes quite clear who he's modelled that on. And the stories are really good, and you want to get to the end, and then they stop. And then there's sort of a section in between where the person who's doing the reading, it's sort of a few examples of a successful second-person narrative where you, the reader, try to find the continuation of the narrative, and you find the book and think, yes, great, I'm going to get back to what was happening before, and nope, it's a totally different story. But it's really good. And the same thing happens again and again. And I thought, naively the first time I read it, that at some point towards the end I'd be working back out again and I'd get the continuations of all these interrupted narratives. But nope, Mr. 1970s postmodernist Italian living in Paris guy didn't do that. He just sort of left you dangling. Thank you, Mr. Calvino. Even then, I read it when I was about 19, and I always wondered what it would look like. I wanted to read a book where that was done, and it didn't exist. Perhaps it has been done somewhere else, but I didn't know about it and still don't. So, in the same way that many years ago there was an advertiser, an American, some of the first American adverts I saw, Remington Shavers. It was so good, I bought the company. Do you remember that? Yeah. The idea was so good, I wrote the book. I don't know if it's a good idea, but the book didn't exist, so I had to do it. That sounds really aggrandizing, doesn't it? I don't mean it like that. I just wanted to see if it would work or not. And I was young and didn't worry about the possibility that it might not, so I did it. Youth can do that to you. You don't yet have the artisan skills, but you do have this recklessness, really, that you kind of sometimes lose as you age, I think. So I had a go. That's that. Inspiration for Black Swan Green? Not really. I was listed for a list at Grantham magazine, like a UK literary magazine. They do a list of possibly interesting writers to look out for in the future. I was on it. They asked for a bit of homework, just an unpublished thing. Never written a short story in my life. But I had some scrappy notes from a very, very, very early attempt when I was about 20 or so. And that was a sort of a more autobiographically sort of my miserable childhood kind of a typical first novel. I quite like the idea of actually sort of writing that with three novels under my belt already. So sort of writing my first novel fourth, as it were. That short story kind of worked okay. And then I realised that, getting older. I think I was a father by that point. Yes, I was. I became aware of a spectrum I hadn't noticed before, a spectrum on which all writers occupy a place or a zone, or certainly all books do. And at one end you've got, it's sort of, one end you've got a book that Haruki Murakami would be a good example of. There's no human mud in it. There's no messy, tangled relationship with your mother. He's not interested in it, and it's fine. And when he's good, he's really, really good. And I'm not saying better or worse, but he's a very hygienic writer in terms of human relationships. And then, you've got Marilyn Robinson, where it's got almost nothing but interfamily relationships, and that's wonderful. And when she's always very, very good. She's written a duff sentence in her life, I think. I became aware of this spectrum and thought, I think without knowing it, my first three books are on the hygienic end. And I'm a dad. I've got kids. I'm married to the same person for a while, and we got a kid now. So if things get rough, we're going to have to work it out. And this sort of sticky human mud stuff became much more interesting to me. It's not so much an inspiration, just a sort of a shift in interest, and bolstered by a morbid dread of repeating myself. I love writing, and I want to be able to earn a living from it until the day I die, hopefully. Some writers, most writers, the fact is there are many more people publishing books in their 30s than there are in their 60s. What happens to them? Why? Where do they go? I think one reason one possible cause of literary stagnation is that people get stuck writing variations of the same book again and again. I put quite a lot of energy into making sure that I'm not repeating myself. And if an idea like Dejima would force me to write a historical novel, because it hasn't existed for 150 years, it would force me to go back and learn how to write a historical novel. I thought in my naivety it was just another genre like science fiction, but they wear old-fashioned costumes instead. Totally different. And this is why it took so long. I didn't know any of this. I sort of had to teach myself how to do it. But historical novel, you need the history, you need the fiction. How do you get the balance? Yeah, the research, just the... I was just mentioning on the radio this morning, you're writing a scene at night, you need light in the room. Running it now, you switch on the light. Or don't even do that, we can assume the lights are on. 200 years ago, no lights. How do they do it? Do you use pig lard candles, or do you use sperm whale oil lanterns? You need money for sperm whale oil. It's expensive to go and get. Pig lard, much cheaper, but it stinks and it smokes so badly you can't read or write. Now, you've got to hide most of this, otherwise you get a piece of fiction that reads like a lecture, but you have to know it, or you're a clever bunch, you readers, and you can smell out a fraud in a moment. So I had to learn all of this, but I'm glad, because it's not Cloud Atlas Part 2 and Part 3. It's something else, and you want your children to be individuals. And you want them to do well in the world, and you want them to have their own identities. And out they go, and good luck. I'm on a new thing now. I was working in the hotel on the way over. It's great. But different. And it's important. It's always different. Thanks for your question. That was great. Are we okay for time? One more. Whoa, okay. Just because there's a gender disbalance... but you're both females. Females? What am I saying? Female one, female two. we just had questions from men so far, but there's two ladies here. Quick. I can do both. Go on. Yeah.
What of your works are you most proud of?
Thank you very much. That's a quick question, and I can answer it quickly. They must go in reverse order. Because if they don't, it means I'm getting worse. So, I meant that to be neither humorous nor ingenious. You're giving me too much credit, but it would be really depressing if the earlier ones were better than the most recent one. So, literally reverse order. I'd probably put Ghost Written ahead of Number 9 Dream, just because Number 9 Dream, difficult second book, and things are doing very differently now. The second book's always hard. You've been writing the first one the whole of your life, and then suddenly you're on a two-book deal, and you've got to get the next one out in 18 months, and you don't yet have the muscle to tell your editor, no, damn you, it'll take another 3 years, and you'll be grateful. So that's why second books can sometimes be problematic, and I'm no exception. But apart from that, reverse order, please. Literally. And I hope that's always true. Thank you. Zong, light speed, lady at the back. Go on, just one more. I don't know where this water's going, but honestly, it's going nowhere near my bladder. It's just like evaporating through my skin pores. It's great. The air is drinking me.
It's the humidity. It's the humidity. Hi.
Yes, hi.
I'm afraid this might be one of these journalist questions, so...
That's fine.
But I just wondered, you know, in Ghostwritten, there's a lot of kind of critique of the experience of the Chinese under communism, and in, you know, Cloud Atlas, there's sort of some sections about nuclear politics or, you know, the politics of nuclear energy. And I guess I just wondered how you feel about, you know, whether your books have some kind of effect on these kinds of political issues. Do you think about that? Does that just kind of organically play a role in the way that you produce these books? Or are you kind of hoping that they actually kind of change people's thinking about these issues?
You know, change the world and make it a better place
exactly.
for children. Yeah.
Exactly.
No. I'm not being dismissive of your question. It's a really good one, and I'm much more. When you have kids, you become truer, humbler, and a more useful idealist than you ever were when you were age 16 and knew everything about everything. So it's not that I'm politically disengaged. It's really important. I think it would be naive to suppose that powerful people would read my work and be influenced by it. Politics and ideas. Politics is everywhere. It's in the most intimate aspects of our lives. 50 years ago, if I slept with a man in England, I think I could be hanged at some point, actually. Not so long ago, but certainly I'd have been sent to prison like Oscar Wilde. Now it's fine. And this is proof, I think, that some things do change for the better. You've got a great trade unionist here. I forget his name. And he says something like... change is inevitable, progress is optional. Isn't that a great six words? Aren't they great? That's so true. I'm off your question. I've talked a little bit this evening about where my books start. They never really start with ideas. Some writers do, and good luck to them, that's great, and that's the way they work. With me... the ideas that are in the books, that they sort of, I think of them as carp in a rather murky pond. And at first they're not there. And then they slowly rise to the surface. And, aha, this is what the book's about. Thank you. That's sort of how what ideas are in my books, that's how they come. Picasso, I think, had a great quote about, first I find something, then I go searching for what it is. And that's really how it feels like when I work. Gosh, I compared myself to the Beatles, to Picasso, to all sorts of things. What kind of ego trip am I on? That's how it feels. I think if you write realistically about the world in a mimetic mode, if you write about... the relationship between the individual and the state, you can't avoid this stuff. Then politics and ideas will enter your work, whether you want them to or not, automatically. and it's welcome as well. I want other things in my books too, but the ideas components are important. But probably in the totem pole of one of the arrangements of novelists' heads that I have, then kind of the thinker, the disseminator of ideas would come three or four heads down below, kind of maybe the imaginer, maybe the stylist, maybe the structuralist, and kind of the ideas person would probably come down number four. Different writers, kind of DeLillo would be an example of a writer where the idea is right at the top, and that's where they belong, and he does it really well. He's a damn good stylist as well. So maybe he's sort of a two-headed totem pole, where you've got the idea man and the stylist there. But yeah, it's a pretty lame way to end the evening. But yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.